You know, when you go through the New Testament, especially the Gospels, the period of Christ's life that led up to the great Passover and his personal sacrifice, there are a tremendous number of places in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John that you can draw from and build upon something that relates to the days of unleavened bread. Probably the greatest, and I mean outside of the Passover season itself, probably one of the greatest is Christ's discussion with the group, the multitude, and with his own disciples about "I am the bread of life," and the tremendous struggle that was for people to grasp and understand what he was talking about, offending many of his disciples who left and never came back. They didn't hang around long enough to be there at the Passover and come to grasp and understand what he was talking about when he said, "You have to eat my flesh and drink my blood." I would say that's probably the greatest of all of the Passover Days of Unleavened Bread metaphors that precede that Passover. There's another one that's smaller in size, but it has an equally sharp focus. I'd like you to go back to Luke chapter 12, and I'll build the sermon, or the second split this afternoon. I'll build it around what I would consider to be probably the second most focused piece of instruction regarding the attitude and the spirit, the heart that goes along with the Days of Unleavened Bread and the Passover season. In Luke chapter 12, Jesus Christ talking with his disciples in the ongoing training session that they went through for 3 years, made the following comment. Luke chapter 12 and verse 1. He said, "In the meantime, when an innumerable multitude of people had gathered together so that they trampled one another, he began to say to his disciples, 'First of all, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy.'" Now here is one of the great locations, Passover-oriented, Days of Unleavened Bread-oriented scriptures that deal with leavening. And here he says to his disciples first and then to others later, "Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees," and he identifies what it is, which is hypocrisy. Now, hypocrisy is a common word to all of us. We know what it is. We know the word. We could probably all give illustrations of what it looks like. In the day and time in which Jesus Christ was speaking, hypocrisy had a somewhat different meaning, or I should say its origin. Its meaning was the same, but its origin was rooted in the Greek theatrical world. We have all seen the universal symbols of theater, the two masks, the one with a smile, the other with a frown, comedy, tragedy. You know, these have become, in the world of theater, the universal symbols of the theatrical arts. In the time of the Greeks, masks were literally worn. When an actor came out, unlike acting today or acting in the modern world, when an actor came out, he literally wore a mask. And the mask was so designed and engineered so that it had voice enhancement qualities. I don't know in terms of theater, the performing arts, anything that really is comparable today. For those of you who are the old timers in the audience, you can go back to the days of songsters like Rudy Vallee back in the 20s and 30s when they did use a megaphone for singing. And so the old cheerleader's horn, Rudy Vallee had a small one of those, and I'm sure there were other singers. I simply remember him personally from seeing photos and illustrations and film footage where he used a small megaphone for voice enhancement. Well, in Greek theatrical arts, they were built into the mask itself so that not only did you not see the face of the actor, you didn't really hear their real voice. These actors, using both a mask and a voice enhancement, were called hypocrites. This was the proper technical name for the art. And, of course, as etymology goes, It then evolved and worked its way down to the fact that anyone who is masking the true face, masking the true voice, then became known as a hypocrite. And Jesus Christ here in Luke chapter 12 and verse 1 says, I want you to watch out for the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. You know, it's interesting that the Greek word for hypocrite, which almost is spelled the same, is found only in the Synoptic Gospels. In other words, you're only going to find it in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And the term is used only by Jesus Christ himself. Nowhere else, and no one else in the New Testament, uses that specific word, hypocrite. Now, there are levels of hypocrisy as seen from Christ's perspective. I'd like you to go back to the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus Christ literally began his instruction of his disciples. Here's orientation, very first class. The opportunity to get your first instruction from Christ on what life is all about. You know, you and I know this area backward and forward. And yet here is where Jesus Christ introduced his disciples to hypocrisy. In Luke chapter 6 and verse 1, he says, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Did I say Luke? No, I hear too many pages turning. I know this is a group that can get there faster than that. Okay, Sermon on the Mount, everybody. Matthew 6. And I'll wait till I hear you stop turning. Sorry. You know, after enough years, you get to the place you say, something's not working here. Everybody knows where Matthew is. It doesn't take that long to get to chapter 6. Thank you for letting me know that I misinformed you. Okay, Matthew 6, verse 1. Take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet before you, as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do charitable deeds, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deeds may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. First instruction on hypocrisy. Christ gave three instructions on hypocrisy at the very first meeting, instructional meeting with his disciples. He said, all right, I've told you about giving offerings. Now let me talk to you about how to pray. And in verse 5 through verse 15, he instructs them on prayer. And when you pray, you shall not be like the hypocrites. For they love to pray standing in the synagogue and on the corner of the streets that they may be seen by men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. He goes on then to instruct them in how to pray, and including in that particular instruction also a sample or model prayer. Instruction number 2. After telling them how to give offerings and how to pray, he also said, let me talk to you about fasting. And so in verse 16, as he had done in both the previous cases, he began with the example that he found personally detestable. He said, moreover, when you fast, verse 16, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance. For they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you fast, anoint your head, wash your face, so that you do not appear to men to be fasting, but to your Father who is in secret place, or in the secret place, and your Father who sees in secret will reward you openly. At the very beginning of the ministry of Jesus Christ, he acquainted his disciples with hypocrisy. You know what's interesting? I look at a group of people right here who have all absorbed the teaching. The elementary teaching of Jesus Christ, given to his disciples in the Sermon on the Mount, has been absorbed by the Church of God, by its culture, and frankly, it's been absorbed by people far broader and far wider than just ourselves. And by that, I mean this. I don't see any ostentatiousness when I see offerings taken up on holy days. It is extremely low-key. I wouldn't know, and neither would the person passing the basket, you wouldn't know the person who was giving $100 from the person who was giving $1,000. And that's the way it should be. Now that's what Christ was trying to get across. No one needs to know what you put in that basket. No one needs to know by the look on your face, the manner in which you put it in. They don't need to know what you gave. God needs to know what you gave. That's as far as it needs to go. I would say you have a model every holy day on how to do it right, just by looking at the environment. Prayer, same way. I don't know that I've ever seen a member of the Church of God stand on a street corner and pray. Unless there were a special event on a street corner where we were all gathered. I mean, we'll have a dedication sometime for the new building, and somebody may stand in a public place, meaning in front of the building, and they may pray. Well, that's a different ballgame. But for someone to unilaterally say, well, I'm downtown Cincinnati, it's rush hour, let me find a busy corner, and let me show them how it's done. No. No. You know, again, elementary. I cannot, in over 40 years of attending Days of Atonement, I can never remember seeing a person who was uncombed, unwashed. In other words, somebody who obviously looked absolutely physically miserable because they had worked on making their countenance look that way. You know, some of us have bad hair days. That's a different ballgame. And, some of us in fasting do become ill, and that's unavoidable. So sometimes, somebody comes, the morning cup of coffee wasn't there, and the migraine is in its place. But I mean deliberately saying, okay, now today's grooming is mess it up, don't shave, and do something that lets people know that I didn't take a bath today. No. The elementary teaching that Jesus Christ gave to his disciples has been well understood. It has been well absorbed, and it's a part of our culture. Let's go to the opposite end. You know, this is elementary. This is 101. Let's go to grad school. Let's go clear out on the other end of the spectrum. To do that, we need to go to Matthew chapter 22, because hypocrisy has many faces, and they range from the most obvious and patent to the most subtle and virtually indiscernible. Now, he was able to construct his own classroom in the Sermon on the Mount. As we go through Matthew, Mark, and Luke, we also see that the disciples provided living examples, which he could then say to his disciples, all right, here's what has happened. And you know, the very nature in which Matthew, Mark, and Luke wrote these books tells us that editorially they had seen it. It is the author who is capturing the essence. And so these men, Matthew and Mark and Luke, are saying, you know what, I saw it. I grasped it. I understood it. And their editorial comments note that. Matthew 22 and in verse 15. This was one of his classic conflicts with the leadership of the day. In verse 15 it says, then the Pharisees went and plotted how they might entangle him in his talk. So that there was motive. How can we trip him up? And they sent to him their disciples with the Herodians. So it was tag team. There was a Pharisaical delegation and a Herodian delegation. And they said, let's see if we can work him. And they said, teacher, we know that you are true and teach the way of God in truth. Nor do you care about anyone, for you do not regard the person of men. You know, I'd like to have been there and heard the tone of voice, because sometimes it's a dead giveaway the minute you hear the voice. There's only so much syrup that you can put in the voice before you say, this is not genuine. But let's just say that they they kept a straight face, and they said this in a way that appeared sincere. They said, "Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar or not?" Now, you know, that's a damned if you do and a damned if you don't question, because the Jews hated the Roman occupation. And to say you should pay taxes would not endear you to the Jewish population. The Romans were in control, and that tax was mandatory. And to say, no, you don't pay that tax, was treason. And so this was a lose-lose proposition. Jesus perceived their wickedness. Again, Jesus' ability for insight was such that I don't know how quickly he perceived it, but Matthew says, you know what, he could see through them. And so the first part of his answer had nothing to do with taxes. The first part of his answer was, why do you test me, you hypocrites? In other words, why have you set me up? He said, show me the tax money. Give me a coin. And so they brought him a denarius. And he said to them, whose image and inscription is this? Show them the coin. And they said to him, Caesar's. And he said to them, render therefore to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Now, you just saw a sophisticated exercise in the practice of hypocrisy. This was, I have a motive. I have intentions to do something, and here is the setup. And Jesus Christ said, don't do that to me. Why do you come in that spirit and in that attitude? This incident, of course, as you can see by the context, is case specific. The accusation of hypocrisy relates to the actions that were going on at that particular time. But it's still instructional. It is ungodly to set someone up, is what Christ's instruction is showing, for the purpose of malice. If they had genuinely wanted to know, it would have made a completely different context for discussion. But they didn't genuinely want to know. They were asking the question maliciously, to hurt, to injure. Now, this is the most sophisticated end. So we've gone from Matthew 6, the elementary, that we've all grasped. That one we've got down pat. We've gone all the way to the other side, to the most sophisticated. All right. Let's put this on the shelf for a moment. And let's walk over to another domain. And let me come back to the question that I asked you. What is the leaven of the Pharisees? Now, so far we've given an answer, haven't we? We've said the leaven of the Pharisees is hypocrisy. But there's more than one answer to the question. Turn to Matthew chapter 16. You know, if this were an exam session and we were in a classroom giving an exam and the question had been asked, well, what is the leaven of the Pharisees? And you had put down, it is hypocrisy, you would have had the answer right. But if you'd put down something else, you could also have been right. Matthew chapter 16 will demonstrate that. Matthew 16:1 says, then the Pharisees and Sadducees came and testing him. So again, we've got a setup. Testing him, asked that he would show them a sign from heaven. And he answered and said to them, when it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, it'll be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites, you know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign, and no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he left them and departed. So they ended their discussion. He said, you're setting me up, and I'm not going to take the bait. And he turned around and he left. Now the disciples are watching. They're observers. The learning of the disciples was both by being taught and by observing the actions. And this was one of those cases where they're watching Christ and they're looking him over and they're making their own deductions. When the Pharisees had come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Now, understand the setting. The setting of the time was Christ's feeding of the 4,000. The event with the Pharisees asking him for a sign followed the miracle of feeding a multitude of 4,000 people. So fresh on the disciples' mind, because it had just happened, was the feeding of this phenomenal group of people with 7 loaves and a fish. So when the disciples had come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. And then Jesus said to them, "Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees." You know, it's amazing how a guilty conscience works. And they reasoned among themselves, saying, "Is it because we have not taken any bread?" In other words, "Oh, no, we forgot to buy groceries." You know, this was a traveling entourage, and somebody had to be a quartermaster. We look at their life and we don't realize that when a group that size travels, somebody has to be the quartermaster. He has to be sure that provisions are there, that food is there, because they're on the move. And so you go to a village, you take care of the supplies, and somebody's conscience stabbed. They said, "Oh no, we forgot to buy food." And Jesus, when he perceived this, he said, "Oh, you of little faith, why do you reason among yourselves because you brought no bread? Do you not yet understand or remember the 5 loaves and the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up? Nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? How is it that you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread, but you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees?" So I said, "Look, put your guilty conscience aside. I fed all these people. You were there when I fed them. You didn't buy groceries. That really is not a problem." He said, I was talking to you not about bread, but I wanted you to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees." Now, you know, considering what we've looked at so far, Matthew 22 being case specific, you could deduce at this point in time, if we stopped at verse 11, where he said, "Don't you understand I'm not talking about bread, but I'm telling you to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees," that they would have said, "Oh, yeah, he's talking about hypocrisy." Well, if you guessed that, you'd be wrong. Verse 12 gives the answer. "Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees." There was more than one leaven. There was more than one Pharisaical leaven. One was an attitude that particular group of people carried with them, which was hypocritical. The other one was a teaching base, a doctrinal base. And in this particular case, they perceived the other one. So it's interesting to note, as we walk toward the Passover, as they walk toward the Passover, and we look at leaven, we look at more than one thing as being, in this case, the leaven of the Pharisees. One being an attitude, the other being a teaching. At this particular point in time, it helps to have at least a brief, and it has to be extremely brief, but a brief description of Phariseeism. And we can literally only touch the very surface of the issue, since the attitude that produced the heart of a Pharisee had its origin probably in the period when Judah lost its statehood, was taken into captivity by the Babylonians, struggled through that 70 years of limbo, and then began to rebuild under Ezra and Nehemiah. So this period of time where all their structures fell down, the temple was destroyed, the temple processes were destroyed, the sacrifice and the administration of the Levites, all of that came to an end when Nebuchadnezzar came in and brought down Jerusalem. And so how do you maintain your continuity? How do you maintain your identity? How do you maintain some sense of order? it is sensed that springing from that time period and growing gradually toward the days of Christ was a system that by the time we reach the days of Christ is described as the Pharisees. Their manner, their system, their way. Pharisaism sprang from a grassroots movement that chose to work outside the ordained structure of the Old Testament. And you could say, well, understandably, the temple isn't functioning. The system isn't functioning. The Levites are not functioning, so somebody has to pick up the ball and run with it. As they did that, they developed a system that once the temple was restored and the system was restored, I guess one of the better ways to say it is they didn't want to relinquish the position. And so you had two systems functioning simultaneously. Once the temple was restored, the Levites came back into action. You had a system that went all the way back to the law. How do you validate yourself? How do you maintain credential? You maintain your credential by the teachings of your scholars, by the teachings of your wise men, and their commentaries, their interpretations, and their readings of the law then become standards upon which to base actions and conduct and instruction. Now that is the briefest, you'll have to pardon the brevity of it, but that's the briefest description of what took place in the period between the destruction of Jerusalem and the time of Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ, as he came on the scene, saw a well-developed system. And that system always referred back as its justification to the traditions or the teachings or the instructions of the elders. It's sobering to note that the position held by the Pharisees is recognized as being perpetuated by the system of rabbis and synagogues that carried down through the ages, literally to our very day today. You could say the rabbinical system of today is the current generation of a system that goes all the way back through this entire string. When the temple was destroyed by Titus and his armies, Judaism moved up to the Sea of Tiberias, or the Sea of Galilee, depending on how it was said, and in the Tiberias area, the schools resumed in much the same way as they had to following the Babylonian destruction. It is important to understand that modern rabbinical teaching is the most current variant of that particular school. Now, let's go to Mark chapter 7. Because I've given you, both from Matthew chapter 6 and also from Matthew 22, I've given you the biblical evidence of Jesus Christ labeling certain actions as hypocritical and therefore leaven. I don't know of any better place in the entirety of the Gospels, or the Bible for that matter, to go than Mark chapter 7 to demonstrate the other side of the coin. And that is to show the doctrinal side of the leavening of the Pharisees. Mark chapter 7 and verse 1. This is one of those cases where the Pharisees caught the disciples eating without having gone through the necessary rituals. And so they were sitting down and they were eating, but they had not gone through the ritual cleansings. Verse 1, it says, "Then the Pharisees and some of the scribes came together to him, having come from Jerusalem. Now, when they saw some of his disciples eat bread with defiled," that is, with unwashed hands, "they found fault. For the Pharisees," this is part of Mark's commentary, he wants you to understand the system, "for the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the tradition of the elders." So, somewhere in the system, the elders had dictated, this must be done before you sit down to eat. I remember the first time that I traveled into Jordan. and I learned the traditions of the elders of the Arabic world, and that was when you ate, this hand, when you sat down at the table, cardinal rule was, this hand goes behind you. You eat with this hand. This hand never comes out to the table. Well, as an Occidental, I'm saying, well, you know, what difference does it make if I eat with this hand or that hand? And then you find out the traditions of the elders. You find in a very rude, and I'm not speaking of modern Jordan or modern Amman, but in a very rude and agrarian culture, the necessities of life were taken care of with this hand. And I'll leave to your imagination what all they were. And therefore, this hand didn't go on the table. This hand was back here, and this hand you ate with. And you say, okay, I understand. Now, I don't know where the elders of the Pharisees and the rationale for coming up with theirs. It was instructional sitting in Amman to find out where that part of the world came up with theirs. And I said, makes perfect sense. I understand. So he said, verse 3, as Mark is explaining, the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands in a special way, holding the traditions of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other things which they have received and hold, like the washing of cups, pitchers, copper vessels, and couches. So he's, again, explaining the washings. Then the Pharisees and scribes ask him, why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat bread with unwashed hands? And he said to them, well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites, as it is written. Now, here we have Pharisees, here we have hypocrisy, but how are they connected? This time it doesn't have to do with attitude. This time it has to do with teaching. He said, here's the problem. This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And as a result, in vain they worship me. Why? Well, teaching as doctrine the commandments of men. Now, you know, it's not improper to have subsidiary instruction from men that augments or supplements or helps explain the Bible. But Christ is saying, we're not augmenting or supplementing, we're reversing. He said, in vain they worship me, teaching as doctrine the commandments of men, for laying aside the commandments of God. See, he sees these in juxtaposition, not as one helps you understand the other, one helps you do the other, but one actually conflicts with the other. For laying aside the commandment of God, you hold the tradition of men. The washing of pitchers and cups and many other such things you do. And he said to them, all too well, you reject the commandment of God that you may keep your traditions. You know, I think sometimes we can go too far in giving the Pharisees a bum rap. Christ was not arguing with their technical nature or their fastidiousness. He was arguing with, when God's law is here and your traditions are here and they are actually in conflict one with the other, you will say, this I have to keep before I keep this. And he says, that is hypocrisy. Here's a case where he literally combines the hypocrisy and the doctrine into one. He said, you hypocrites. And he goes on, if I may place words in Mark's mouth, you hypocrites, your doctrine is what you are doing in a hypocritical nature. If you look up the word Pharisee, it means a separated one, somebody who's special, who is not contaminated by the masses. They set themselves up as holier than the community, holier than the people around them, better and more righteous than those surrounding them. And it was for this reason Christ said they were hypocritical. When you claim to be holy, the only justification for holiness you have is my law. But when your traditions contradict my laws and you do your traditions first, I see that as hypocritical. I see your doctrines and hypocrisy, in this case, are literally synonymous. Jesus Christ saved his double-barreled shotgun for the week before they killed him. If you want to see the longest single pointed barrage of accusations about hypocrisy, you have to go to Matthew 23. Now, I'm not going to take you through these for a couple of reasons, but let me tell you where they are. Verses 13, 14, each one of these is a charge. You hypocrites. Verses 13, 14, 15, 23, 25, 27, 29. No wonder they killed him. Now, the reason I'm not going to take you through them is, first, there's not enough time. Well, no, I don't know which is first. There's not enough time. That's one reason. The other reason is, if you had a complete collection of commentaries, the commentators really honestly don't know the specifics of the charges. I can read them to you. You can read them to yourselves. We'll both understand about the same amount after reading them. There were charges that were rooted in what was going on that day and time that it's not always easy to find out what it was. He said, for a pretense you devour widows' houses. Well, commentators will tell you what they think that means, but the honest truth is they don't specifically know what it means. So we simply have to look at several illustrations where we say, well, we know that Christ was totally upset with what you do and what you teach, but we don't totally understand what it is in specific terms that you've done. You know, there's an interesting illustration in the middle of that Matthew 23 that we are all familiar with, and I'll make an allusion to it in just a moment. This whole sermon came about, I've told the churches in Portland and in Hood River that I've told them several times and said, you need to Bible study the newspaper. And what is current, what is relevant, what is of the day. How can you be more relevant to an audience than to talk about what is current? And so on the 3rd of April last year, there was a fairly sizable article in the Oregonian by an author named Jeffrey Weiss. The footnotes indicate that Jeffrey is a staff writer for the Dallas Morning News. And so this would have first appeared in the Dallas Morning News in Texas. And the Oregonian picked it up as a part of the Universal Press syndicate, and they printed it prior to Passover. So this was one of the annual pre-Passover news articles. And Jeffrey Weiss, W-E-I-S-S, Jewish gentleman, Jewish author, or reporter, then wrote the following article entitled Simple Command. The title of his article is Simple Commandment, Much Interpretation. And I won't read the whole article to you because it is lengthy. This is the article. But I had never seen a more classic, modern demonstration as an overlay on the scriptures I've just read you in all the years I've been in the ministry. And so I built a sermon around it last year for the churches in Portland. Jeffrey Weiss goes into the history of the days of unleavened bread, and he goes into the history of Passover for the non-Jewish reader. And then he comes into modern times. In the process of doing so, he identifies the fact that he spends a reasonable amount of time in this article interviewing and quoting Rabbi Yaakov Horowitz, who is the chief resident rabbi at the Manischewitz Company. So, virtually all the matzos that you see, I haven't seen Manischewitz wine and I don't know how long, but I'm sure they're still making it, and all the Manischewitz products. So he is interviewing the rabbi in residence at Manischewitz, which is the world's biggest manufacturer of matzo, and he's building his article around it. Now, you and I, every year, Passover time, if we look for instruction, the instruction is really very, very short and very simple. You know, the lengthiest description in the Old Testament of what leaven is and what we're supposed to do about it takes about three verses. Exodus chapter 12. Where Jesus Christ is giving the disciples Old Testament. Where God is giving the Israelites instruction in Egypt on how to keep their very first days of unleavened bread. And when you look at Exodus 12, and you read the instruction on the unleavened aspect of the days of unleavened bread, it's really very, very brief. It's verse 15, and then it's repeated in verses 19 and 20. He says in verse 15, 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day you shall remove leaven from your houses, for whoever eats leavened bread from the first day to the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. And there's very little elaboration in verses 19 and 20. 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he is a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened in all your habitations. You shall eat unleavened bread. Not a lot of instruction. Mr. Weiss, as he begins his article, talks about leavening, and he makes a statement that puts a little flag up in regards to our sermon. This is a direct quote. He said, quote, thousands of years of rabbis have come up with long explanations for how to observe that seemingly simple commandment. Okay? Now, I read you the commandment. God gave you fundamentally one verse with a two-verse repeat. Mr. Weiss says, thousands of years of rabbis have come up with very long explanations on how to observe what really appears when you open your Bible to be a very simple command. He then takes you through a tour of the Manischewitz plant. He says, a month before the days of unleavened bread, they shut the plant. They close it down. They literally dismantle the plant. They scrub it and they sanitize it from front door to back door and all the machinery, so that when they start rolling out Passover products, they are absolutely sparkling. You know, you look at a matzo and you wonder, well, why does the thing have to be built the way it's built? The answer really, very, very simple answer. They are meticulously concerned about even the slightest contamination of the smallest individual spore of wild yeast. The grain is ground dry, which is not normally done, so that there's no moisture to begin a fermentation action. Water is not added to the flour until literally the last possible moment it can be added before baking begins, so that a spore that may have floated in when somebody opened the door may not have fallen on the wet dough and began the process of fermentation. All those holes, those of you who are cooks, you know that you bake most of the stuff in your oven somewhere in the 300 degree range if you're baking. Matzos are baked at 700 degrees. All those holes are there for good reasons. That matzo doesn't stay in the baker very long. The holes are there so that that intense heat can penetrate and go through every single part of that matzo to assure there is not any moisture whatsoever anywhere within that cracker. Moisture being the catalyst that would allow the spore, if there, to begin to work. And so he goes through this whole process. And after going through the whole process, describing the nature in which it is done, the way the dough is made, the way the water is added at the last minute, the heat of the oven, all of this to ensure absolute perfection of the product so that it complies with what we've just read. Then Mr. Weiss asks the rabbi another question. He said, well, the introductory statement is not in the form of a question. He says, He says, and how many of Manischewitz kosher for Passover processed mixes for cakes, cookies? Oh, no, I'm reading this wrong. He asks a rhetorical question of us, the reader. He says, and how about many of the Manischewitz kosher for Passover processed mixes for cakes, cookies, and other goodies? One of the ingredients, so we've moved away from matzo and we've moved to all of the other Passover goodies. One of the ingredients is sodium carbonate, baking soda. Isn't that a leavening agent? Now these are, I'm reading you, you know, I'm so you know, this is quote unquote. I've added no commentary. Continuing the quote. Quote, "It may look that way," Rabbi Horowitz said. It may look that way. But appearances can deceive. Now you figure that one out. Okay? I got my box and there's baking soda. And I say, isn't that leavening? And Rabbi Horowitz says, well, it looks that way. But appearances can be deceiving. All right. If you catch me at McDonald's during the days of unleavened bread, I guess I could plead that it looks like a Big Mac, but appearances are deceiving. Okay. But then Rabbi Horowitz goes on to explain. And as he explains, it is deja vu of Mark 7. In Matthew 22. The rabbis decided that matzo, once certified as kosher for Passover, okay, this is the matzo, went through that whole process we described, dry ground meal, water added to the meal at the very last minute, the whole thing slapped in a 700 degree oven, comes out the other side, and we have kosher for Passover matzo. The rabbis decided that matzo, once certified as kosher for Passover, can never be de-Passoverized. Would somebody like to show me in Exodus, Leviticus, where they got that one? You begin to understand traditions of the elders? Not even by later contact with leavening. Okay? I got a matzo. I ground that matzo up. And I've turned that thing into flour by grinding it. I add baking soda. Once kosher, always kosher. It doesn't matter what I put in there. It cannot be, in the words of the article and the rabbi, it cannot be de-Passoverized. Not even by later contact with leavening. All the Manischewitz mixes start with Passover matzo meal. That by definition can't be ritually contaminated by the baking soda. This is the rabbi's description. Most people don't understand that, Rabbi Horowitz said. I have to admit that I was, before I read the article in that category, and I read the article several times, and I'm still there. The article ends with this short paragraph, quote, "It's not a question of what it looks like," he said. "It's a question of what the rabbis call it." End of quote. Do you understand what Christ was saying in Mark 7? Do you understand the combining of the two elements that he describes to his disciples as the leaven of the Pharisees? I have never seen a more candid, forthright, direct, and since this was in April of last year, seasonally appropriate piece of information that helped me understand this very simple pre-Passover admonition from Jesus Christ to his disciples. I hope you found it not only instructional simply from the educational standpoint, but I hope, as I think all of us do who speak, that you also allow that to be a part of your meditative process between now and the days of unleavened bread, to ask as we look at our spiritual leaven if there's anything that we need to remove at this higher level, not just the crumbs in the car and the sweepings of the house, but the crumbs of the heart and the sweepings of the mind.